Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the proposed Charlotte 2040 plan hits a snag at City Council. Not everybody's on board with the plan's proposal to end single-family zoning. Vaccine availability is expanding, even as Mecklenburg County is assigned 10,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Governor Cooper vetoes the legislature's bill mandating the opening of all public schools across the state. The General Assembly can't muster the votes to override it. And as the Hornets prepare to welcome fans back to home games, LaMelo Ball makes news again and becomes the subject of a weekend update bit on Saturday Night Live, with Charlotte joining him and Gastonia in the spotlight. Here to bring us up to date on those and other stories is David Borax, a reporter for WFAE News. Good morning, David.
Hello, Mike.
Good morning. Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Hello to you.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Eric Spanberg is back. He's not glad to be here, but he's back. He's managing editor at the Charlotte Business Journal. Eric, welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Unhappily here.
Okay, and Joe Bruno is here from Channel 9, Eyewitness News, WSOC-TV. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Mike.
So the Charlotte 2040 plan, let's start there. That was years in the making. It was aimed at guiding Charlotte's through future growth with a goal toward correcting the mistakes of the past and to address contemporary concerns about racial equity and upward mobility. But as City Council began to discuss this plan on Tuesday night, I believe it was, it hit a brick wall over the plan's proposal to eliminate single-family housing zoning. Here's City Council's Tariq Bokhari.
We need to take a hard, long look inward, pump the brakes.
So the city's been holding public meetings about this plan for months. Does the urgency Bokhari expressed stem from constituent feedback about what they've been hearing in these meetings? Who wants to take that?
I think in part what's happening here, Mike, as you said, this has been in the works for a couple of years. It's a 320-page document. And I think, like many things in public policy, what has happened is a lot of people were kind of snoozing through this and then all of a sudden started looking at the details and discussing the details and said, oh, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for this. And so that in turn has kind of prodded the City Council to say, we need to slow down and take another look at this, to the extent that the lobbying group for the real estate industry is asking for a full 1 year delay. I don't know if it's going to stretch out that far, but it seems very unlikely that it's going to meet the timeline that they had established.
So they'll be voting on this in 2040. Is that right?
Yes. Exactly.
at Monday's meeting, Bokhari went on to say to city manager Marcus Jones, quote, I hope this is crystal clear to you that there is no path that this can happen in the next 60 days. We have staff that's done a lot of hard work, but I think it's become crystal clear that a lot of work has been focused on things that should have not been focused on. The plan encourages sidewalks and saving trees and creating more transit-oriented development in addition to these changes in zoning policies. Were his comments strictly aimed at the zoning part of this? Joe.
I think the elephant in the room here is single family zoning and changes that could come as a result of this plan and the UDO. Basically, we're expanding what would be allowed in single family zoning. So duplexes and triplexes and sometimes even fourplexes would be allowed to be built.
And I just wanted to say, Mike, that this is not an idea that was totally a surprise to the council. This is something that that Jayoba and the planners started talking about in 2019.
And we had Taiwo Jayoba on this program in 2019, and I think again in 2020 talking about this, so it should be no surprise.
But now that we're, you know, actually talking about doing it, I think the urgency among folks who don't like it is greater. And those folks would be people in single family neighborhoods.
Nor is this idea novel to Charlotte. There are cities all over the country that are starting to look seriously at zoning laws, and they're starting to recognize that if they're going to get their hands around affordable housing and other issues, they've got to change those laws.
In fact, when we first talked about this, I believe we had the mayor or a city planner from Minneapolis on this program, where they have been doing this for a while, and it's working out well, according to them. It's working out well for them. There were some other objections. I think there were objections to process and about whether the city planning staff is actually listening to the citizen comments it has received. Is that accurate?
I think part of the answer on the listening to the answers it has received, something around 5,000 people, I think, have weighed in to one extent or another. And the answer was that they are waiting until after the public hearing, which is March 22nd, and then they're going to weave those comments and suggestions into the plan. So that's why that piece has not been included, but that's what council was asking about. Now, just back to timeline for just a second. The plan was March 22nd, you have a public hearing, and then you vote the following month by you, I mean the city council. I mean, again, that seems highly unlikely. And council has also scheduled a meeting basically in between to delve further into this issue. So this is going to be an even longer drawn out conversation.
How unusual, if at all, is it for the city manager, Marcus Jones, to come before council to talk about a plan that's been on the calendar for a while, only to discover that the council is completely in the opposite direction from the plan? How unusual is that?
Go ahead, Joe.
I mean, I can't think of a time that he has brought something up that he knows the votes aren't there for.
Yeah, I mean, generally, that's the way those conversations go, is that everybody's kind of informed and relatively on the same page. So this was unusual.
But there is a little bit of a sense of urgency on this because they need to pass this plan, which is kind of the grand vision. And then after that, they need to pass a unified development ordinance, which is something the state is requiring. And Eric, you may remember what the deadline is on this, but it's something that, you know, it needs to happen in short order.
Yeah, there's a July 2021 deadline, and then there's another one the following year to get everything synced up. And there were, David, to your point, there were questions about exactly how the state mandate affects what is done in Charlotte, and there were not clear answers, at least not yet. So, Mike, I think it's safe to say we have a muddle here.
Okay. And there's another level to these criticisms about single-family zoning that cropped up. Among the more outspoken responses to the single-family zoning proposal came from Councilman Braxton Winston, who tweeted that fighting to maintain single-family zoning is advocating for segregation.
I think it's completely unfair to allow one type of person to build and say, you know, another type of person can't build simply because we want to keep the character of our neighborhood the same. That's racism.
But Victoria Watlington, who represents West and Southwest Charlotte on council and who is also Black and who also raised questions about the single family zoning proposal, bristled at Braxton Winston's characterization of the opposition.
To stand up and say you're about restorative justice and then reduce our opinions to NIMBYism and racism, it's reckless.
So this program, as you have said, allows duplexes and triplexes and quadruplexes to be built in places where single family homes have only been allowed to be built up to this point. Is opposition to this racially or economically based, or is it simply resistance to growing density and allowing the look of the city and neighborhoods to change?
D, yes. All yes. Of the above.
Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Mike, if I could, you know, the big picture here is that we have a supply problem for housing. We just don't have enough. And what is it, the 100-something people that are moving here every day? We can't build housing fast enough. So as the planners are putting together this long-range plan, they said, well, how do we increase the number of housing units here? And again, simple supply and demand suggests that if we have more housing units, then prices at some point will come down. The question is, will this address the supply fast enough, or will there be some interim period here where it doesn't really work the way it's supposed to? It could take years for this to happen. And you know, it means that there, as Victoria Watlington has pointed out, it could mean that, you know, somebody's not going to buy a $1 million house in Myers Park and tear it down and try to build something that's going to earn more money for them there. They're going to do it in places where they've gotten good deals on houses. And that, those are places where we need affordable housing, but it also is going to affect those populations more.
Go ahead, Joe.
The Myers Park Homeowners Association is one of the largest groups that has come out against this, and they are asking people to write to city council members to oppose it for three reasons. They say that the current environment, because of the pandemic, is not conducive to educating residents on this massive change They claim that the plan lacks any meaningful specificity. I'm sorry, I can't get that word out this morning. And such details will only be released after the scheduled vote on the UDO, and then just a blanket allowance of multifamily dwellings on any single family lot is not effective planning.
Glenn.
That word's going to haunt me.
I think what's being missed here is that this alone will never address the housing problem. Markets will always favor those with money. And when you're talking about expensive neighborhoods and expensive lots, simply putting a duplex on it will not suddenly bring racial integration. You need look no further than the area around Freedom Park, where we've seen duplexes spring up, where we've seen other single family units spring up in the middle of a very, very affluent neighborhood. We have not seen racial integration follow. I think unless our elected officials and I are willing to take some type of affirmative action to integrate these neighborhoods, it's not going to happen. If you're depending on market forces, you're going to be waiting for a long time.
Well, having talked to Marcus Jones about this years ago now, I don't know that the impetus behind this is strictly to integrate neighborhoods. It seems to be to allow greater density in neighborhoods and allow people an opportunity. Maybe they can't afford $1 million home, but they can afford one quarter of a quadruplex in that neighborhood. And that puts them closer to where they want to live because they work in that area or whatever it may be. But one of Victoria Watlington's concerns is that if you allow higher density housing in single family neighborhoods, it would lead to more rentals and drive out opportunity for home ownership. And that's always a concern of people who own homes, that suddenly the neighborhood will be filled with people renting and that lowers home values. Is that a valid concern? Sure. Are they experiencing that elsewhere?
I think a lot of the concerns we're talking about are valid. That doesn't mean that you can't change anything. And so that's really what we're getting into here is that people are bringing up concerns and some of them are saying, well, you know, then everything has to stay the same. And obviously there's got to be some sort of compromise. And the nexus of the problem is, as I said, going back to the beginning is, while all this was going on, most people weren't paying attention. So now, yeah, in a way, we're kind of starting over as people educate themselves and try and figure out where they want things to shake out in this debate.
Joe.
This will not ban the construction of single family homes, though. That is a common misconception. You will still be allowed to build single family homes in the city of Charlotte if this goes through. It's just you might have duplexes or triplexes, more of those in your neighborhood.
And it also talks about where those might be, specifically along major arteries. So if you've got a neighborhood of single family homes that has single family homes that go right out onto the main road, the possibility is that the ones at the corner or in that block that is facing the main road could become multifamily.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of neighborhoods in the inner city have the urban core have duplexes on the corners of single family home neighborhoods already. But this is also to address problems that came about through the 20th century with federal policies and deed covenants and redlining policies and zonings that used to be put up so we could control the kind of people who lived in certain areas. And this, all of those dropped away except zoning, which also keeps a garage from opening up next door to your $100,000, $500,000 house, I suppose. So some things about zoning are good. We'll talk some more about this and move on to the growing availability of vaccine when we come back. And we'll ask Joe Bruno to increase his specificity as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. On the next Charlotte Talks, the perennial debate is back over arts funding in Charlotte and the Arts and Science Council's role in doling out that money. The City Council is looking to change things up. Instead of budgeting millions each year for the ASC, the city would set up its own board to decide how the city's arts money is spent. Where would that leave the ASC? We get the view from City Hall and the Arts and Science Council when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're here with Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, and David Borax from WFAE News. An argument in favor of allowing the zoning changes as part of the Charlotte 2040 plan, which we've been talking about this hour, is that it will permit people who might not otherwise be able to afford a home in a particular area to buy into a duplex or a triplex or a quadruplex. So when a builder comes into a neighborhood and tears down a single-family home and puts up a multi-family unit in its place, do those homes become more affordable, or do builders and developers see this as a way just to buy a house for $1 million and put four homes on that same property and sell them for $850,000, $900,000 each? What happens?
I think that goes back to what I said earlier. You can find places in some very affluent neighborhoods where there have been duplexes built recently. Those are not, by any stretch of the imagination, affordable homes. When you look at the when you look at the value of land, when you look at the character of the neighborhood, the desirability of the neighborhood, those houses tend to track the value of those neighborhoods. So I think to some degree, those fears are overstated.
Well, I thought it was interesting. Steve Harrison from WFAE did the story with, he was interviewing Jatanya Adams about Five Points over near Johnson C. Smith. And that she was saying that this did not lead to more affordable housing. It sent the prices up with the duplexes and triplexes that were being built. So, I mean, this is a nuanced issue. It's not going to be as easy as just I'm for this, not for that.
Joe.
Well, I have some personal experience here because I used to live in a fourplex in Charlotte, in Elizabeth, and the four individual units sold for, I think, only about $200 each at the time, many, many years ago. And it allowed me, as someone who can't afford a $1 million home in Elizabeth, to live in this neighborhood. I was able to rent a unit in this fourplex for about $1,200 a month for a two-bedroom, which is much more affordable than, you know, a two-bedroom might be in one of those larger apartment complexes that we're seeing in other parts of the city.
At least one council member said we haven't been paying enough attention to this, and you just mentioned that the Myers Park Neighborhood Association said that the pandemic is not a good environment to have an open and extensive discussion about this, so people don't know enough before we make this decision. But city planner and assistant city manager Taiwo Jayoba told council that the outreach on the plan has been the most robust in his entire career. And he came here from someplace else. And he said he's heard from 5,000 people, including people of color and others who have been previously left out of these discussions. Have they not been, why the problem here, if that's true?
Well, I mean, 5,000 is, you know, what's Charlotte, 1 million people? So,
well, yeah, but how many people come to these meetings? There are meetings about all kinds of things in Charlotte all the time. Yeah. And how many people show up for those meetings? 10, 15, 20?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's great that they're reaching out to a number of people, and they're reaching out to a more diverse group of people. I'm not criticizing that, but what I'm saying is, again, I just think that a lot of people who do have an interest in this didn't pay attention until it finally got in front of council, you know, in a more, I guess, high profile way. And there was debate. And now all of a sudden people are saying, hey, wait a minute. And I do think there's a valid point about the pandemic. There is a difference between participating in public meetings online and virtually versus being able to go out to these sessions. So, whatever the reason, this is not going to happen on the timetable that the city wanted it to happen. I think that's the bottom line.
Well, speaking of timetable,
I'm not at all surprised that this has generated so much controversy. I don't think anything brings out public comment more than zoning type things. Right. I've been to zoning meetings in every part of the city, in Black communities and white communities, in rich and poor. And, you know, NIMBY is not just something that affects affluent neighborhoods. You run into that same problem in Black communities and brown communities. People want to protect the integrity of their communities.
So the city was hoping to hold a public hearing on this on March 22nd with adoption of the plan in April. I take it the meeting may go on, but the adoption will be delayed. Is that what we should take away from this?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think that you may end up with subsequent public hearings based on the interest, to Glenn's point, because I don't know that you can just get this done in one session.
Okay. So this week marks a year since the first case of COVID-19 presented in North Carolina, a year. And now we have 500,000 plus deaths throughout the country from this. Things are looking up, though. After the first 6 weeks of the Biden administration, President Biden said this week that there would be enough doses of the vaccine so that all Americans could be vaccinated by the end of May, which is really picking up speed on the timeline there. And more good news, these vaccines will soon be available to more people in North and South Carolina. In the next week, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper also moved up the start of vaccinations for frontline essential workers in the state's Group 3. That's farm workers and grocery store workers and others. They became eligible this week.
The third vaccine and improving vaccine supply for the two we already are getting will help us get more people vaccinated more quickly.
And among those now eligible to get the vaccine, as I said, are grocery store workers like Jeff Hope, who spoke with WSOC-TV.
We are in contact with several people from different walks of life and different places they come from, so the vaccine is very important.
So, Joe, you spoke with several grocery store workers and managers, and one told you that finally being on the list will bring peace of mind. They've been out there dealing with thousands of customers over the last several months. How concerned have they been?
Pretty concerned. I mean, you can't work from home and work at a grocery store. And, you know, one of their main concerns was that their families had to stay home and they weren't able to go into work, but they had to actually go in and serve different customers. So they were worried about bringing a virus home to their family. So finally, this is another tool for them. They're wearing the mask, they're standing behind the barriers at the register, but now they can get that extra level of protection with the shot.
So we have the third vaccine coming in, the Johnson & Johnson. We have the other two, the Pfizer and the Moderna, which require two shots each, while Johnson & Johnson requires only one shot. And we're getting all of those increasing numbers of all those, particularly if the president is right and everybody can get a vaccine by the end of May, we're going to have to really pick things up. But just how easy is it to get yourself on a schedule for a vaccine? I have to ask the question. This seems like a comedy of errors to me.
Well, Mike, I think you...
Where you go. There have been examples of people who can't get on the list, but many people I know, including... my kid just got an appointment within 48 hours. They're a frontline worker at a coffee shop in Charlotte, and this afternoon they'll be getting a shot.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm getting my shot today, my first shot today, and I made the appointment, I don't know, a month ago, and it was a challenge then. I had to actually get on the phone because the website didn't work right. And so yesterday, just as an experiment, I went to the websites for this, for everybody who has a website, to try to sign up. And at one of the major hospital systems, I tried to sign up for an account because I didn't have an account there. You have to have an account. And because I didn't have an account, it said, we can't verify your identity. Click here. So I did, and it sent me back to the top. So I filled it all out again, and it said, no surprise, we can't identify your identity. Click here. And it sent me back to the top. It was maddening. And I finally got an appointment in Lincolnton at the end of April. That is not acceptable.
But you're getting one today, you said.
Yes, I did. I backed out of the appointment. I'm not doing double appointments. I just wanted to see how difficult it was for the average person to negotiate this. It's not easy. It's
but
really
he also
hard.
Got a discount on his cable bill by the end of that. So it was.
There are two things here. So Mecklenburg County changed the website that they use to have people register for shots. And from what I understand is it's a lot easier now. That it goes through StarMed's website for to register for your first.
Yes. Well, I was on that too. Hold on. I was on that too. And let me tell you, I think I know how to use the internet, the interwebs. I think I know how to use them. Well, forget it. It was hard.
So the alternative, though, is not having registration and having people wait in lines for hours on end with no guarantee that they'll get a shot like we're seeing in other states. And I don't know if you'd be more miserable waiting 6 hours in your car.
No, it just seems to me that this could be easier than it is. And I'm not sure why it's not easier than it is. This reminds me of what happened with the rollout with the Affordable Care Act. And maybe part of the problem is we have 14,000 entities doing the same thing. Could we not have one entity doing it all and just pointing you to where you are supposed to go to get your shot? I don't understand why it's so difficult.
Okay. Anyone? Anyone?
No, that's right. Anyone?
So, just on, to your point, here. Mike, we are starting to get more places that will have the vaccine now with the Johnson & Johnson here. Yeah. Some of the grocery stores will start it. I think Harris Teeter announced this week that they're going to start rolling it out there. Some of the pharmacies now have it. So it should be getting easier. And also, you don't have to go on the web to do this. You can make a phone call. And I think some of the people that I know who've gotten appointments called, they got somebody on the line, they scheduled an appointment. So
I have to say that in every case, I've had to make a phone call.
So Mike, one thing to your point that is interesting, a little bit more serious note is Gibby Harris this week, when she was talking to the county commissioners, said that when vaccines first began, there was basically 100% attendance, for lack of a better term. And now that number has started to go up as people are making multiple appointments and forgetting to cancel an appointment once they have one somewhere else. So this could get trickier. I hate to disturb you, but it could get trickier.
Okay, so the vaccine people, the people who are now eligible are in groups 1, 2, and 3. The people in group 4 who are people who have preconditions like asthma and cancer and vascular disease, kidney disease, cystic fibrosis, dementia, diabetes, types 1 and 2, Down syndrome, among others, will be moved up to March 24th now so they can start signing up. And that's the other thing. If you know that you're eligible on March 24th, you cannot currently go online and make an appointment for some time after March 24th. You have to wait until March 24th. That seems stupid to me, but we'll move on.
Think of it as a Billy Joel concert.
Well, yeah.
Everybody's going to start going online to get their tickets at the same time.
Okay. President Biden invoked the Defense Production Act to help Merck in their historic partnership with the rival Johnson & Johnson to produce Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. North Carolina has been earmarked to receive 80,000 doses. 10,000 are coming to Mecklenburg County. When might those doses arrive?
They're here.
They're here. They arrived, was it Wednesday?
Yeah, I think it was Wednesday.
And who is handing them out?
Those went to Mecklenburg County, right? I believe those were Mecklenburg County Public Health.
We saw tweets of photographs of the shipping boxes from Mecklenburg County, right?
So, and again, just to remind listeners, as you said, Mike, there are multiple people that are dispensing vaccines. So you have County Public Health, you have the two major hospital systems, and so on and so forth. This is specifically dealing with the Public Health Department.
Okay. And these are easier to store because they don't have to be kept at extraordinary temperatures, and it's only one shot. Once you get the shot, you're done, which has its own benefits, I suppose. Good news in all of this for residents of long-term care facilities and their families, because the rules have changed. What can people now do? Joe.
You are now allowed to see your loved ones inside as long as the nursing home is following COVID protocols and hasn't had a COVID case in about 2 weeks. But you still have to follow all of the rules. You have to wear a mask. You have to stay separated. But at least now you can see your loved ones and it won't have to be outside or through a phone.
And this is because cases are down and continue to decline here and hospitalizations are down. And residents and care workers at those facilities have been eligible to receive the vaccines and probably have by now at least received their first shots. Do we know how many have received their shots, their vaccinations?
I don't know if we have specific numbers for long-term care facilities, but I know that more than 50% of people 65 and older have received a shot. Yeah.
And a word of caution, I keep reading from health professionals that even if you've had your shot, even if you've had both of the two-shot vaccines, you should continue to wear masks and practice social distancing because they're unclear of what your ability to spread the infection may be. You won't get sick, maybe, but other people may, and one of the variants evidently stays in your nasal passages, and you can spread, you don't get it, but it spreads when you breathe out of your nose. Joe, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, the CDC is, though, expected to release some guidance as soon as today, probably next week, if not today, though, telling people who are vaccinated what they can do to safely gather.
And the issue here was simply that they didn't test this. They didn't examine it. We just don't know. So okay. My doctor friends that I know who've gotten the vaccine are not wearing masks now. So they're telling us something there.
So continue wearing your masks unless, of course, you live in Texas, where it's the Wild West. We've had this push to reopen schools in the last several months. The General Assembly here passed a bill that would have directed the state's K through 12 districts to offer in-person instruction to all students beginning in about 2 weeks. Tamara Walker Kelly is the president of the North Carolina Association of Educators. She says teachers want to return when it's safe, but not now.
Lawmakers who are voting for Senate Bill 37 are telling educators across the state that students, educators, and all of our other school staff do not need 6 feet of social distancing like the rest of the state. That is absolutely unacceptable.
Well, good news for Tamara Walker Kelly. Governor Cooper vetoed that bill, and the Republican-controlled General Assembly failed to find enough votes to override that veto. They fell one vote short of a supermajority that's required to override. That means it won't go on to the House. Does that put an end to this?
There was a rumor going around that they were going to try another override vote, I think Wednesday or Thursday, and that didn't happen. Obviously, they don't have the votes yet. It strikes me, Mike, that this is something where actually the two sides agree on this. Both agree that we need to get people back for in-person learning. It's how we do it that they're disagreeing on. And that clip that you just played is about the crux of the matter, which is, do we let people come back without any restrictions at all, or do we still try to keep some of those safety protocols in place? The other thing about this is that most school districts in the state already have in-person learning in some form, so they would meet the law. It's the 25 or so that have not done it yet that are at risk here.
In vetoing the bill, the governor said, I want schools to open, but he said, I want them to open safely, and this doesn't allow for that. He said that essentially that it didn't require social distancing, and it removed local districts' ability to return to remote learning if conditions warrant it. That seems to me to be smart. Wouldn't it be easy to put that in the bill and then have the governor sign it? No questions, no answers. All right, well, we have to break. Well, you're off the hook for the time being. We'll come back maybe and you can reconsider answering that question. We're coming back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Coming your way, because it's Friday, David Borax is here from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV Channel 9. And Glenn Birkins, founder-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Getting back to the bill that the governor vetoed and that the legislature failed to override the veto of, Democrats, about a dozen Democrats, voted in favor of this bill originally. Did they change their minds when it came to overriding the veto?
I mean, simply they did, yes. And I think a lot of this is,
why?
I think this started with pressure voting for it because of constituents. Some of the more Republican-leaning counties would be my guess. And then, as it got down to this portion of it, probably hearing from the governor and some other things that may have changed their minds. I mean, part of this, though, you were saying, this seems like something that would be easy to work out. What strikes me is, it's such a strong political talking point for both sides. And here we are. I mean, school's going to be out by the time they resolve this.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the state's Department of Health and Human Services and Dr. Mandy Cohen have both called for all K through 12 schools to offer in-person instruction to the fullest extent possible. That's a quote. This sounds like another mixed signal, is it? I mean, we have the legislature saying, let's go back right now. The governor says, well, let's go back, but make sure it's safe. Mandy Cohen saying, let's go back.
It still comes down to that question of how we do it. And, you know, there's great disagreement on that over that simple thing of distancing and that sort of thing, wearing masks. You know, do we go back and pretend everything is back to normal, or do we do it with some safety protocols? And the Democrats seem to be, you know, erring on the side of caution here. And again, it doesn't affect every school district. Good joke.
What I'm expecting the House to do now is pursue some of these school reopening plans through local bills, which would not be able to be vetoed by Governor Roy Cooper. But the trade-off is local bills can't apply to every single county. Only a certain number of schools would be able to be included in these. So the House is going to consider a local bill to reopen schools, but it would only apply to Ashboro City Schools, Carteret County Schools, Haywood County Schools, Randolph County Schools, and Yancey County Schools. But again, the governor cannot veto that bill. Right. So that's a way that the House and the Senate can pursue this strategy of reopening schools.
Again, I go back to what David said, which I think is a really important point. You know, we're talking about maybe 25 districts. I mean, yes, we're talking about everybody in a sense in terms of how they do it. But then a lot of that will happen at the local level in terms of how the schools operate. We're really talking about 25 school districts. That's really the crux of this fight.
And this does continue the trend throughout the pandemic here of the legislature second guessing the governor on lots of the public health directives that have come out. And, you know, it's a slippery slope. I think that's also at play here. If the governor were to sign a bill that directly counteracted something that he had put into an order, it could open the door for other things to happen. And, you know, these things have gone to court. So
Mecklenburg County CMS has been back in session with options to go back to school for students and teachers. How's that been going? Have we had any outbreaks or any problems with that so far?
So far, so good, but it might be a little early to declare it a success. But so far, they're off to a good start.
Okay.
Yeah, we're 2 weeks in, is that right, I think? So it's
something
early.
Like that. So locally, the locally famous, and they are locally famous, the No Grease Barbershop. They had opened a location at South Park Mall called Knights of the Razor. They did this in January on a temporary one-year lease, but then they were asked to meet with the mall's management. I think it was last week. Simon Properties owned South Park. And they were told then that the mall wanted them to vacate their lease prematurely so that they could lease it to another tenant. Damian Johnson, who's been on this program several times and who owns that barbershop with his brother Jermaine, said they had done business with other Simon Properties locations for a decade.
Because of our prior relationship with Simon Property, you know, this really had blindsided us.
They'd spent about $60,000 to $70,000 in upfitting their space at South Park, even though they knew they were on a temporary lease. What happened? Why would South Park ask them to take a lease that ends at the end of the year anyway and get out earlier? Why would they ask that question?
I don't know the answer to that. I think one important thing to recognize is that it was a temporary lease for a year, but I believe there was also a provision in that lease that allowed South Park to terminate it before the year was over.
Okay.
So you know, for whatever reason, Simon Properties decided to exercise that.
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, this is part of the business model for malls like South Park and companies like these guys. They, when they get a vacancy, you know, they want rent coming in. So if they can find somebody to come in for short term, and I would actually use, instead of saying temporary lease, I would use a short term lease just to describe it more accurately. And it usually is a case where you're there kind of at the will of the landlord, and you know, you may not be able to stay there. But, you know, here's a case, and these guys have been pointing out that, you know, they've been good tenants. They have an existing relationship with the landlord, and, you know, they thought they could be able to stay for a while. And they, you know, there was this great story last week on Axios Charlotte, which in which they talked about what a dream it was to be able to get a spot, a black-owned business getting a spot at South Park Mall. And, you know, that's why this has blown up into the situation that it is.
Well, they're one of two Black-owned businesses, I believe, at South Park Mall. And there is a happy ending to this story. They get to stay, at least until the end of their lease. Is that correct? What made the mall change?
Well,
their idea?
I think there was a lot of, the public opinion and just the spotlighting of this issue. And remember, Mike, that the mall, we're told, the mall was saying they had a chance to get a long-term lease tenant. But Damian Johnson and his brother were saying they were interested in being long-term tenants, and they wanted that first right of refusal, so to speak, and didn't get it.
Yeah, this story lacks specificity.
Word of the day.
That's right.
there's a lot, there's a lot we don't know, because even though Simon Properties did put out some statements, we really don't know a lot about what has happened behind the scenes there.
Well, community activists are pushing for a change in how CMPD officers serve search warrants under something called the Campaign Zero Initiative. This is part of ongoing efforts at police reform here, and it has to do with what are known as dynamic searches. What are dynamic searches?
Those are the ones where they break the door down, and they say that's about half the searches that they do. Those always create a little bit of an uproar when they happen, because people, they end up on viral videos. They end up being the complaints from folks about how it's happened. But, CMPD is saying that they're going to try and change some of the things that they do. They're going to, serve warrants only during the daytime. They won't use explosive devices or flashbangs or anything, that they would have to knock and wait before they go into the home. So they're trying to adjust their tactics to address some of those concerns.
And they've made that decision not to serve warrants only in the daytime? Because I read the other day that seems
impractical. This has not happened yet. It hasn't happened yet. It's a proposal that came up at the Safe Communities Committee at the council.
And CMPD is pushing back on that, because they say if there's a homicide in the middle of the night and they need to serve a warrant right away, they want to have that capability. But that's something on the table that, activists would like to see, is that specific time frame for when warrants can be served.
It should be noted that the George Floyd Act, which is in Congress, would do many of these things, among other things. I believe it is already passed the House, and it's now in the Senate, where it probably faces a much more difficult road. But many of the things that CMPD has announced are part of that.
So this came up because the Charlotte City Council Safe Communities Committee was hearing that proposal. Were they hearing it from a subcommittee? Were they hearing it from community activists? From whom were they hearing these suggestions?
I believe it's community activists, including Robert Dawkins, are asking for this. And Robert has been a constant watchdog on CMPD for years now. And he's been involved in many of the major policy issues, and many of which the city has adopted over the years. And I think the debate is happening right now because folks like him have brought it forward.
And there's the killing of Breonna Taylor also.
Yeah. There have been a number of horror stories about no-knock warrants and they often, or they too frequently, have ended badly.
So like some of the other stories we've talked about today with regard to city council, this is an ongoing thing that will be discussed again and again and again. And I believe that the CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings is set to meet with the City Council Safe Communities Committee again about these proposed changes that they're kicking around sometime next month. As COVID restrictions have eased, sports venues are getting ready to welcome back fans. We heard about this, I think it was last week, when the governor said we could bring in more people. But the Charlotte Knights fans are going to have to wait. This is a mystery to me. Major League Baseball has made this decision to delay the start of AAA East season until May 4th. They play baseball outdoors the last time I checked. Why are they doing this?
Yeah, as you say, Mike, this is really because of Major League Baseball, and this is the way that players train together. And so what Major League Baseball is trying to do is to keep minor league players and major league players who are gathered together at spring training typically, they're trying to keep them separate as much as possible. And that's leading to the delays because of the way rosters are being restructured. And I won't take you through the rest of it, but that's why they're waiting a month later.
That's why you're on the program, because we have a lot of sports to talk about. So will they be working these delayed games into the schedule down the line, or are they just taking them out of the schedule?
It looks like they're going to try and get a full schedule for AAA, not for the lower minor league tiers. They already knew they were going to have about 120-game schedule, but AAA, they're likely to get their full 142 games, and Joe is signaling me, so he will come in from the bullpen now.
Okay. It's also, it increases the chances that maybe these athletes will be able to get a COVID-19 vaccine if they delay the season. So maybe there will be fewer cancellations if we go down this route.
See, the Bryce Harper of specificity right there.
The nice. Panthers, would it be fair to say that the Panthers are in a rebuilding mode right now? Greg Olsen and Thomas Davis, it was announced, I think last night or today, that both have been given one-day contracts so that they can retire as Panthers. Well, congratulations to them. But what is this is not the first time this has happened in that team or any other team. What's the point of that?
Well, this happens all the time when you have players who are beloved with a particular city and team, and then they go somewhere else for the last year or two of their career, and it kind of sputters, and then they want to finish out with that team with which they are most identified, and they usually end up becoming team ambassadors and things like that. So I would expect with both of these players so popular, so involved in the community, that will happen with them as well.
It's the ultimate feel-good story.
Yeah.
Speaking of popular, the Charlotte Hornets. The Hornets,
Mike,
are
you know I have a rule. I don't do this show unless we talk about LaMelo. That's my rule.
That's right. Well, not yet. Hold off.
Okay. All right.
The Hornets are going to welcome back fans to home games beginning March 13th. How many people will they be welcoming into the arena?
They'll have about 3,000, which is 15%. That was the limit that the governor set for buildings with 5,000 or more capacity.
And they've already put tickets on sale for those opening games for season ticket holders and corporate sponsors. Sales open to the public moments from now, in like five
That's
minutes
right.
from
That's
right now. Any predictions on how fast they'll go, those things?
I suspect they'll go pretty fast because you have limited capacity and you've already had the sponsors and the season ticket holders with the first crack at it. And I think most people generally follow up the news roundup with basketball ticket
yes.
purchases. So this is a good double
okay.
bill.
So now, Eric Spanberg, it's lucky that you're here because we get to talk about LaMelo Ball very quickly. Here we go again. What's he up to now? My gosh, he's got another accolade.
Yes, he is Eastern Conference Rookie of the Month for the second consecutive months. We've only played 2 months of basketball, so that's a pretty good start. Also part of the rookie All-Star team that unfortunately will not be able to play because of a truncated All-Star weekend.
Right.
But LaMelo is doing just fine, and he's even bringing Charlotte some national attention. I bet you're about to mention.
Why, yes, he is, because his father is known to be loquacious. His father, LeVar Ball, who was one of Saturday Night Live star Kenan Thompson's characters, who he lampoons because of his braggadocious nature. Last Saturday night, Kenan Thompson brought him back during Weekend Update with Michael Che, and he put Charlotte in the spotlight in the process.
We are almost halfway through the NBA season, and the front runner for Rookie of the Year is point guard LaMelo Ball. Here to comment is his outspoken father, LeVar Ball. But it's been a good year for you. LaMelo is playing really well, your son.
You damn right he is. Yeah. And he's playing for the most storied franchise in all of basketball, the Charlotte Hornets. Charlotte, North Carolina, the regional banking capital of the world. Gateway to Gastonia. No mountains, no oceans, but enough humidity to make your balls sticky as taffy.
So you think LaMelo's gonna win Rookie of the Year?
Oh, he's got all the awards locked up. Rookie of the Year, locked up. MVP, locked up. Prettiest hog at the Mecklenburg County Fair, locked up. LaMelo has got this. And after he's won, he's gonna unite both North and South Carolina into a Super Carolina called Carolosis.
Should we be happy about this?
We'll take what we can get, man.
Just as long as they spell our name right.
Well, we have a letter here, an email from Brent Messer, who says, "We Gastonians are ecstatic over Kenan Thompson properly identifying Gastonia's relationship with our stepsister city, Charlotte, conveniently located across the river." So thank you for that, Kenan. David Borax, Glenn Birkins, Eric Spanberg, Joe Bruno, thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.